I'm Mark Simpson, and this is Intersection. The Federal Aviation Administration is back to work after Congress passed a temporary funding measure. That is set, though, to run out in September. We'll talk with Chair of the U.S. House Transportation Committee and Winter Park Republican John Mica about the next steps going forward. And these days, traveling 30 miles seems like nothing in our fast cars. But generations ago, people walked everywhere. They would undertake 100-mile journeys on foot. And that's what the Russian author of War and Peace, Leo Tolstoy, loved to do. We'll talk with a scholar who retraced some of Tolstoy's long walks in Russia ahead on Intersection. Earlier this month, the FAA was shut down after running out of funding. There was a political fight between Democrats in the U.S. Senate and House Republicans. Congressman John Mica, who chairs the U.S. House Transportation Committee, was deeply involved in the process and is here to talk about it. Congressman Mica, welcome to Intersection.
Good to be with you.
So, Congressman, you've been at the center of a debate that up until 2 weeks ago held up funding of the FAA. There was a debate about funding rural air service. Democrats are also concerned about efforts by Republicans to repeal rules that make it easier for airline workers and railroad workers to unionize. Why did it take shutting down the FAA through late July into early August to pass a temporary funding measure?
Well, what's actually happened is the Democrats control the Congress by wide margins for 4 years, and they passed 18 extensions. The last authorization for FAA expired in 2007, and finally, after 20 extensions, several that we've had to do this year, I said that we're going to have to do something to get them off dead center. So I included a provision that I guess they didn't like. It eliminated subsidies per ticket of more than $1,000, pork-laden subsidies that affected three airports. They balked at that, but they finally, after our passing an extension with that provision, did adopt it. But they actually put people out of work for 2 weeks because of their reluctance to pass even that kind of minor cut.
Well, Congressman, you're known as someone who's not afraid to cross party lines to make a deal, yet this debate over the FAA with the mix of concern over union rules and the Rural Air Service did seem to fall on party lines.
What's happened is the issue of union rules is only something that they've tried to use to demagogue the issue and actually bait the media, who's fallen for that by even bringing it up. The extension had no provision whatsoever dealing with union rules.
But have you made a call, though, that for a permanent measure to be in place, the union issue has to be addressed?
Well, the union issue is one of six remaining major issues. And actually, I have offered to compromise, which the Democrats and the Senate have refused to do. The House passed a provision in their bill which eliminates the provision that the Obama appointees put in place after 75 years of requiring a majority of workers who are going to be represented. That would be, if there were 1,000, you'd have to have 501. They changed the rules to certify for a union that you only need a majority of whoever shows up. What they did also, which is unfair, is leave to decertify the extraordinary majority that they're protesting against. So I've been willing to compromise on the issue, even not take the House position, and they've demagogued that as trying to make that the forefront issue, when there are issues of pork subsidies for some limited number of airports. There are funding level issues. Mm-hmm. There are slot issues at Reagan National. There are other major pending issues.
Well, let me ask you, the union issue, though, is getting some traction. The Association of Flight Attendants, which is an airline industry union, has been protesting because a permanent funding measure for the FAA has not been passed yet. They followed you to an event you attended in Texas the other day and have been visiting your offices in Florida. What do you think about their concerns, and is this really a debate over union regulations and rural air service?
I feel sorry for those folks because they've been duped into and actually being used in this debate, because this is not about that subject. It is one of a number of subjects. They should have been concerned for the last 4.5 years, and particularly the 4 years when there was no reauthorization. They should be supportive now of my efforts to pass long-term legislation that would create policy, improve safety, get us competitive in the world markets for next-generation air traffic control systems. So they're being used as pawns and duped tools in a larger national debate. And actually, I feel kind of pity for them because of the way they've been abused by some of the leadership in Washington.
Congressman, the temporary funding measure expires on September 16th, only a short while after Congress returns from its current recess. Do you foresee that things are just going to start stalemated like they were over the summer?
Well, I can assure folks, just as I inserted a measure that may have been controversial but tried to move the process forward, that I will use every means possible to get a long-term, four-year reauthorization. After 4.5 years of Democrat delay, we will find a way to make one of our most important transportation agencies function and also compete in the global international aviation market and put people to work. So I'm calling a halt to the nonsense, and we will find a way to do it, no matter how they try to divert or demagogue false issues that aren't even part of the debate.
What's one thing you'd be willing to compromise on?
I've been willing to compromise on every issue, including the so-called union issue. I've been willing to compromise on the slot issue at National Airport. I've been willing to compromise on the level of funding and work with them on that. We have resolved just about every issue in private negotiations with Democrats, but a few people have chosen to try to demagogue the issue, try to make the media pay attention to non-issues that serve certain interests, and a lot of media, unfortunately, have fallen for it. But I think the public sees through it. They see that the delays are unnecessary, that they could have taken this up, that there were absolutely no provisions that have been talked about that they cause a delay, and that we can all compromise and get this done in the best interest of the American people.
Well, Congressman John Mica, thank you so much for your time, sir.
Good to be with you.
Coming up on Intersection, The Long Walks of Leo Tolstoy. Late in his life, writer Leo Tolstoy enjoyed walking between Moscow and his ancestral home 200 kilometers away south of Tula. He'd become something of a religious leader in Russia at this point in his life, and his walks came to represent a social, technological, and ecological statement. This June, Stetson University Associate Professor Michael Denner retraced Tolstoy's steps with two colleagues during a 4.5-day journey. He joined us to talk about the trip. Michael, welcome to Intersection.
Thank you, Mark.
So Tolstoy was a wealthy aristocrat who could have traveled comfortably in trains and carriages of the day. What was the nature of the kind of statement he was trying to make by making these long walks on foot?
Well, I guess I could start by reading a quote by Tolstoy about train travel, which is a little off-colored, but something that you would expect from Tolstoy. back in 1857, when he was still a relatively young man, he traveled to Europe for the first time, and he wrote his good friend Turgenev, the Russian writer, a long letter about his travels. And I love one of these phrases from one of the letters. It's, "The railway is to travel what the whorehouse is to love, just as convenient, but also just as inhumanly mechanical and murderously dull." And just imagine what Tolstoy would say if he could see people cruising down I-4 in their Ford expeditions by themselves.
And what metaphor would he use to describe that?
If train is a bordello, I don't think I want to go into what driving by yourself in a Ford Explorer down I-4 might be.
But take us into this era of Tolstoy. When people were making these long walks, was it common?
Oh, it was very common, especially in Russia, especially at this particular point in history in Russia. This is Tolstoy did these walks in the 1880s when he was in his late 50s. This was an era of a lot of social upheaval. So on the one hand, you had a lot of the peasantry coming to cities during the off-season when they weren't doing agricultural work and working in factories. You also had a lot of religious schismatics who, for religious reasons, had followed Christ's injunction to leave home, and they were called wanderers and runners, and they didn't have a fixed home, and so they just wandered the highways of Russia.
Well, take us into Tolstoy's world. He was an aristocrat. He was in circles where he crossed paths with many of the elite in Russia, including the Tsar.
Yeah, I mean, you know, Tolstoy's family is one of the oldest in Russia. I guess it dates back to the 13th century, and he came from the creme de la creme of society. He was an aristocrat of the very highest order, and if he had wanted to, he could have personally served the Tsar. He had family members, close family members, who were ladies in waiting for the Tsarina, for the Tsar's wife. So, you know, he traveled at levels. Aristocratic levels that we can't even imagine today. Moreover, he was an incredibly famous man in his own country and in the world at large by the 1880s.
And of course, that leads right into the tumultuous 20th century, especially the early part for Russia was a great period of upheaval.
Yeah, and Tolstoy was at the very center of that. You know, he was, I often tell my students that he sort of founded the hippie movement. He brought together a lot of different strains of thought. He was a vegetarian. He believed in self-reliance. He believed in working the earth. He was, in important ways, the person most responsible for popularizing Eastern mysticism, not only in Russia, but in Europe as well. And so, you know, you get this heady mix of anarchism. He was the leading advocate of anarchism with Eastern metaphysics, vegetarianism, going back to the land. You know, you could see how he could easily fit in with a bunch of hippies from the late 1960s.
Or transcendentalists like Thoreau?
Absolutely.
Or?
He was actually the person most responsible for popularizing Thoreau in Russia, single-handedly sort of introduced the Russian reading public to Thoreau. And I don't know if he was deeply influenced by Thoreau, but their ways of life and their social doctrines certainly came from the same place.
Take me into the actual walks that he was doing. Was it unusual for someone of his stature to be going out on these long, long contemplative walks?
Remember that this is still the 19th century, and we're talking about the aristocracy. So on the one hand, of course, you know, your average count wouldn't be seen dead walking down the highway with a bunch of peasants. But on the other hand, this was an era, I mean, Tolstoy was he loved hunting. It was probably his favorite thing to do up until the 1870s when he gave it up as part of his new sort of religious doctrine. But it wasn't like he stayed indoors all the time. He was an incredibly gifted athlete. And so this walk was, it was a different iteration of what he usually did, but it was certainly coherent with his identity at the time.
Which is interesting. You think about Russia, you think of a bitterly cold place, but it sounds like Tolstoy out there, very much the personification of the Russian bear, tackling the environment.
Yeah, you know, he would take these walks because he was trapped in Moscow. His family had bought a house at the very beginning of the 1880s in Moscow, and he was living in the city regularly for the first time in his life, really. And he would just be driven crazy by being cooped up with all of these luxuries all around him. And so he would leave as early as he could in spring to walk back home. And invariably, he left too early and would end up even in mid-May walking through snowstorms. So the Russian winter is long.
Well, it sounds like what you're describing is a bit of a midlife crisis, and this impacted both his writing and his lifestyle. Explain that a little bit.
There's the way that Tolstoy's life is usually told is that there are two Tolstoys. There's the early Tolstoy, the novelist who wrote War and Peace and Anna Karenina, and then there's this sort of uncomfortable late Tolstoy, this really vociferous, angry person who wrote tracts of about social justice, about religion. He was an anarchist, like I said. He absolutely rejected the authority of the Russian Orthodox Church, which is quite a thing to reject in 19th century Russia. And this all happened right at the end of the 1870s, right after he finished writing Anna Karenina. He spent the next half of his life essentially working through these social, moral, and religious doctrines.
You're listening to Intersection on 90.7 WMFE-FM. I'm talking with Stetson University Associate Professor Michael Denner. He retraced the long walks of War and Peace author Leo Tolstoy during a four-and-a-half-day journey this past June in Moscow's big area. I'm Mark Simpson. Do you enjoy long walks? Are you still out there walking? How about in the heat of Central Florida? Tell us, where are you walking to if you're out there doing it right now? What do you think of this concept of slow travel? How does it impact your life? Tell us on Facebook and Twitter, or send email to intersection@wmfe.org. Well, take us into your walk. You had this 4.5-day trip across Russia. You were advised not to go and do it by friends, that it would be dangerous, unsafe. What did you find?
Well, let me start by saying that we had actually intended to do this walk back in August of last year, but because of the extreme heat and the peat fires that were taking place there, we were paradoxically defeated by Russian heat instead of the cold.
Not the winter.
That's right. And so unlike Hitler and unlike Napoleon, we fell to the Russian summer instead of the Russian winter. But we moved our plans, and we did this walk, really, I guess, the first week of June of this year. And it took about 4.5 days. We left from just south of Moscow. We didn't really want to walk through the really urban sprawl that surrounds Moscow now that didn't exist when Tolstoy was there. And we walked about 30 kilometers a day, which is roughly what Tolstoy walked as well. I didn't really do any training for this. I made sure that I was in reasonably good shape.
You just kind of put on a heavy pack and went.
That's right. We walked with everything that we needed. So we had about 40-pound packs on, and we had good shoes, and we just walked through the Russian countryside, which is spectacularly beautiful and spectacularly large.
What did you discover, and who did you meet?
I mean, you know, it's patently obvious and absurd to say that Russia is really, really big, but I don't think I really realized how enormous Russia is and how few people live in Russia until I walked through what is the most populous area in Russia, and we would go for hours and see no one or nothing. You know, you can just sort of imagine it, that if the area around Moscow is that empty, how empty the countryside and the rest of Russia might be. You know, we were warned by our friends, our very urban friends in Moscow and St. Petersburg, not to do this hike, that it would be very dangerous. This sort of, we would be beset by essentially Russian rednecks, or we would be injured somehow or another, and we would be far from anybody who could help us. The general reaction from our Russian friends was, you know, who in this day and age walks? But what we found instead was that the people in the countryside were incredibly hospitable, something that Tolstoy found as well. You know, when Tolstoy did this walk, he would just, at the end of the day, start knocking on the doors of peasants' huts and ask to stay the night. And in the 19th century, all the way through, I'm sure, through the first quarter of the 20th century, it was just considered typical Russian hospitality that if somebody showed up at your door, you would feed them supper and you'd give them a place to sleep.
Did you discover that yourself, or were you staying in hotels? Well, what did you do?
I have to say that really the highlight of the trip was on the third night. We stayed on an estate by a very famous Russian 18th century figure named Bulatov. He's kind of the Thomas Jefferson of Russia, in as much as he was an agricultural expert. The people at the museum put us up in a grass hut on the top of a hill in the middle of nowhere. Out of nowhere, the director of the museum shows up around 9 o'clock at night, and he's got armloads full of pickles and bottles of vodka and herring. And he just produces this amazing musician, and we stay up half the night around a campfire having this quintessential Russian experience of drinking vodka and eating pickles and listening to Russian folk music, and then fell asleep to the sounds of nightingales and was... we were awakened to the calls of cuckoos. You couldn't imagine a more idyllic experience.
That was the word that was coming into my mind. Well, tell me, Michael Denner, you know, what kind of people did you meet? Tell me some stories from the road. What did you encounter?
Well, lots of anecdotes. What we encountered were people were, like I said, very, very friendly, very curious about meeting a couple or three Americans out in the middle of nowhere in Russia. I could tell a couple stories. For example, I think it was maybe on the second day, we stopped by a tent by the side of the road that was selling kvass. Kvass is this sort of Russian national drink that's made from dried bread that's allowed to ferment in water with some raisins and some sugar. Anyway, we were really thirsty, obviously, and we stopped at this tent by the side of the road and sat down for a glass of kvass. And of course, the waitress was really curious why three people who were obviously foreigners with big packs were walking through the Russian countryside. So she finally got up the nerve to ask us what we were doing. And then this whole time that we were sitting in this tent, there was one other gentleman there who looked shady, let's say. You know, it was the 11 o'clock in the morning. He was drinking a beer, smoking a cigarette, looking at us through his sunglasses, and just sort of staring fixedly while we sat there. And he listened to this story by this woman about how she loved Tolstoy, this star waitress. So she had lots of questions. We answered all of them. He sat there sort of looking somewhat menacingly at us the entire time. And finally, the waitress walks away, and he stands up and walks over to the table. And he introduces himself, and he says, "What you're doing is very important, and I really respect that." And he fished around in his backpack, and this is this quintessential Russian moment. He pulls out a book of poetry by a poet named Yesenin, who wrote at the beginning of the 20th century, much beloved poet. He's known as the people's poet. And he said, "I'd like to give you a gift. This is my favorite book of poetry, and read it while you're walking." And he gave it to us and then just walked off. And I opened up the book, and I realized immediately that this was his personal copy of this book. And the margins of the book were all marked up, and the pages were dog-eared where his favorite poems were. So this was like a very, very personal gift to some American sitting in a tent drinking kvass in the middle of nowhere, but a very, very Russian moment in any case.
How fantastic. Well, what did you discover about yourself? These long journeys walking, this is definitely a moment for introspection.
It was. You know, that was, interestingly enough, I'd like to say that I think anyone could walk 1 or 2 days, 30 kilometers. That's a little over 20 miles a day. That's not particularly difficult. You do need to be in a fairly good shape to walk 3 or 4 days. Ultimately, what was most challenging about it was not the physical aspects, but the mental aspects. The monotony of walking 8 hours a day was really very trying. And so there was some sort of escape into oblivion. That was an interesting experience where you're You know, I was there with companions, and we talked a lot, but there's only so much you can talk over the course of 4 days, walking together for 8 days. And so there were long, long periods of silence. And I look back at those days, and there were hours of my day that were just lost. I don't think I was thinking. I think I just sort of turned off. And it struck me that how rarely we moderns experience these moments of isolation, monotony, where you just stop thinking and stop receiving any sorts of outside stimuli.
Now, at the end of Tolstoy's life, he ended up as an ascetic, giving just about everything away and really trying to enter that kind of realm of being the true mystic. What did that mean for both him, and what does it mean for you having retraced those steps?
Tolstoy really gave all that much up. I mean, he continued to live on his estate up until the very end, and very famously, he just quit home after he really got sick and tired of the demands of domestic life and of modern civilization, and he struck out on his own, immediately became ill. He was 82 years old at the time, he was in a third-class train car and came down with pneumonia and ended up dying in the middle of nowhere at this whistle stop station in the south of Russia called Ostapovo. So the one time that he really did decide to lead an ascetic's life, it didn't turn out very well. He died a few days later in a train master's hut, surrounded by hundreds of journalists and photographers and cinematographers, with his wife not allowed to come and see him. Sort of a tragic end.
Well, how about the end to your journey? What was the resolution of that trip?
We timed this walk so that we would arrive during a conference at Yasnaya Polyana. That's Tolstoy's ancestral estate, which is now a museum, and it hosts all sorts of intellectual conferences. And it was commemorating a journal called The Contemporary, which is an incredibly important journal in the history of Russia. And so they had a bunch of speakers about the position of the intellectual in modern Russian life and about journalism in Russia. And we listened to some really, really bitter discussions about the current state of Russia by these Russians, it was a deeply cynical conversation about the modern state of Russian society and the social web unraveling. And then you can only imagine me and my friend Tom Newlin from Oberlin, we were the two people who were on this walk. And we gave a presentation about our walk, and it sort of almost as a unintentional rebuttal to these Russians' very, very dark prognostications about the future of Russia. We got up there and told this sort of heartening story about how kind Russians were, and the hospitality and the civilization that we found out in the Russian countryside. And I ended up by telling the Russians to take a hike. And I explained to them the double entendre there in English, I recommended that they spend some time in the countryside.
So what advice would you give to others who are planning maybe a long walking trip, or how would you do it differently next time?
No, I mean, this was really a moment where I realized what a wonderful mode of transportation your own two legs are, and how much more intimately you get to know a place. It was sort of distressing because on a couple of occasions, for complex reasons, we had to retrace our day's walk. And so we would walk 30 kilometers, and then we'd hail we'd hitchhike, and we would go back those 30 kilometers back to our starting place. And it would take literally a matter of minutes to retrace the 8-hour-long walk. But at the same time, I was really struck by how much more we saw walking. And, we have slow food, we have lo-fi music. I hope that there's a new movement called slow travel, where people just walk and meet people and see the lay of the land bit by bit. It's a revolutionary experience.
Stetson University Associate Professor Michael Denner retraced the long walks of author Leo Tolstoy during a 4.5-day journey this year near Moscow. Well, Michael, I guess it's time for me to say das vidanya.
Paka. Take care, Mark.
Have you actually made it through War and Peace? How long did it take? Tell us about it on the WMFE Facebook and Twitter pages. You can also check out the Florida Talks blog and send email to intersection@WMFE.org. Support for Intersection comes from our listeners and from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Amy Green is the assistant producer. I'm Mark Simpson, and thanks for listening.